These awful eyes bore into me, and through me, through my entire being, swallowing me irresistibly into themselves as if I were being sucked into a gigantic maelstrom. Absolute panic seizes my heart. I feel myself turning limp and lifeless out of sheer terror. Coming closer and closer, his horrible eyes get more and more penetrating. I can feel how this satanic being, is it Satan himself? Is forcing me into his power. The monster spreads out over me, swallows me, and in a moment I feel I am no longer myself. I am it. I feel its horrible features in my face, its immaterial body in my body, its devilish streams of current flowing like blood in my veins. This hellish, fiendish sensation turns my whole being cold and stiff. My body curls up in horrible cramps. And deep within me it talks to me, without words, through the power which produces words, through the meaning of words. Now I've got you. Now you're in my power. Now you see you haven't been able to crowd me out of your consciousness. In spite of your efforts to do so, you belong to me anyway now. You and I are one. There's nothing to separate us anymore. I am the I in you, and you are the I in me. You are subject to my law of cooling, contraction and solidification. Do you feel how your body is curling up, how you're drawing your knees up all the way to your chest? They're crossed now and your feet are pressed close to your body, as close as if the soles of your feet were joined to your body. Your arms are crossed in front of your breast. Your hands are curled up into fists pressed against your body as tightly as if they were joined to it. Now your head is dropping down onto your chest, pushing itself close between your fists, closer, still closer. Just as if you were in your mother's womb. That's right, and now you've shrunk and shriveled into just one piece. You're getting colder and harder until you become a little oval piece of stone. A piece of stone, rigid, hard and dead. But you still have your consciousness and know that you're dead, that you've solidified into this piece of stone, that you are this piece of stone, you're welled up in it, dead for endless time. For timeless eternity. Look around and see the mountains reaching up to the sky. Do you see all these rocks and stones and boulders? Don't just look at them, look into them. Look into their being. Can you see that all these stones are petrified but conscious beings like yourself, exposed to burning sunshine, raging storms and splitting frost? Every creature, every animal, every human being walks on you and all these other stones. Spring torrents drag you into wild waters, and you rub and scour each other in these whirling rapids. Endless time. Timeless eternity. Horrified, I experience everything the evil one says. This is hell indeed. Alive and conscious, yet locked up and immovable, grown into this tomb, with no possibility of giving so much as a sign of life. To be a heavy, dead stone. To be? No. I am not that. I am only imprisoned, entombed in this stone, but I am not the stone. Myself is not matter. I am the dimensionless self, a spirit beyond any concept of time and space. And with the inner strength of the spirit, just as I learned to speak with it in my telepathic exercises, without body, without mouth, speaking in spirit, I soundlessly scream at the monster, "No. I am not you. And you are not I. We are forever separated in our beings, for you are death, and I am life. We can never be identical with each other. You with your law of contraction and solidification, you're the negative, the reflected image, the caricature, of the eternal source of all life, of divinity resting within itself. You're not a horrible phantom. You're not a monster. You're not the evil one. You have no independent existence. The divine self created you and goes on eternally creating you whenever it clothes itself in a material envelope, in a body. You are the inner being of matter, you are the law that maintains matter, so you have power over my body, because you had to construct it on the command of myself when I was born into this material world and became a person. But you have no power over me, over my creative self, for you're nothing else but the law of matter come to life through my spirit. Not I am you, but I am that I am and you are also what I am. Your essence is contraction, and on the spiritual plane, in consciousness, contraction manifests itself as fear. And you must disappear, because I don't fear. The effect of my unspoken, soundless words is terrifying. It gets pitch dark around me, and the mountains cave in with a deafening thunderous roar. Rocks and boulders fall, the earth opens, complete chaos rages about me. Only I stand firmly on my feet in this cataclysm. As things become quiet again and I slowly return to my senses, I realize I've just had a horrible dream. How good it is to awaken from such a nightmare. My first sensation is one of extraordinary hunger and thirst, but I don't want to waste time with eating and drinking, for my goal is God. I want to get on as fast as possible. I look about me. I am in a spacious room illuminated by soft reddish light. Pleasant, well-mannered people offer me tempting delicacies in beautiful dishes and heavenly drinks in magnificent golden vessels. They try to persuade me to eat and drink with them. I smile. The pleasures of the palate were never a temptation for me. Why should I permit myself to be delayed by hunger and thirst on my path to God? I thank them for their friendly invitation and go on. Singularly enough, I no longer have any sensation of hunger or thirst, but I still can't quite make out where I am and what's going on around me. It is apparent, however, that everyone around me is in constant, chaotic motion. Another one of my first impressions of this place is the strange smell in the air. The smell of overheated human bodies. Not exactly unpleasant, but nevertheless repugnant to me. Little by little my eyes grow accustomed to the subdued light. I am in some kind of an underground cave, where great numbers of men and women are lounging about pell-mell on sofas or rocking and careening about, holding each other in tight embraces, dancing together and making extremely odd movements. I watch them with growing amazement. Are they drunk? Or mentally deranged? To be sure, I have seen animals during mating season when nature is creating a new generation. But even when they are so keyed up that their whole bodies tingle and tremble with passion, they never lose their dignity. They never carry on like these people here. And the priestesses, too, who serve in the temple of love, fulfill their duties with a noble attitude of spiritual dedication because they know in doing so they are laying an offering upon the altar of divine love. How can people fall so low that they debase the supremely divine act of love and make it an end in itself? After all, these are respected, reputable people, made in the image and likeness of God! And yet they act as if they've lost their reason. I recognize some of them as people of rank, statesmen and ladies of the court, but they don't see me. They have neither eyes nor ears for anything or anyone beside themselves. The outside world has ceased to exist for them. They're completely enclosed. Locked up in their own imagination. They talk with each other too, but it seems as if these men and women have forgotten that speech is a spiritual manifestation of man. They use speech to say the most impossible, completely illogical things. For example, I hear one man, as he dances with his partner in a tight embrace, ask her again and again, "Are you mine?" "Yes, darling, all yours," the woman answers, and they go on dancing. A little while later the same couple dances past me and I hear the man, with his eyes half closed, asking the woman again, perhaps for the 100th time, "Are you mine?" "Yes, darling, I am," the woman answers just as untiringly. What's the matter with them? Isn't it enough to ask a question once and get an answer? Why do they have to repeat it 100 times? And how senseless it is to ask a person such a question. A person belongs only to himself. He is a free being with an inalienable right of self-determination. So how does this man come to think he can possess a woman? It's scarcely possible to possess a lion. If even these regal animals don't give up their independence, how can this man get the idea the woman belongs to him? And why is he asking her 100 times? Is he mentally ill? And perhaps the woman, who goes on answering his nonsense, too? And perhaps all these other men and women who are behaving in just as impossible a manner? At this juncture, a tall, broad-shouldered man steps up to me. Seemingly he can read my thoughts, for he replies to my inner questions, "Beautiful lady, don't you know that this is love?" "Love? I certainly do know love. It is a beautiful, noble sacrament when two living creatures love each other with absolute devotion, but not with mere passionate desire for possession. But in the hearts of these people I see no love. I see only that they've lost their senses. That passion, this fever which dulls and deadens those finest, most sensitive nerve centers created for transmitting spiritual revelations, holds them completely in its power. These people should be saved and awakened from their semi-conscious condition." I step up to a very young woman, seize her arm and shout into her ear, "Wake up! Don't let your consciousness be dulled and darkened by passion. You are spirit and not body. Don't allow your body to debase you. Don't let yourself be dragged down lower than an animal. Wake up! Do you hear? Wake up and get out of here. Save yourself before it's too late." The young woman peers at me as if through a veil, like a sleepwalker. "Leave me alone," she says, "I want to be happy." And with that she goes on dancing. Oh, how blind! How could she possibly hope to find happiness through a physical embrace without spiritual content? Happiness is something one experiences in consciousness, happiness is in the self. How could she possibly hope to find happiness through mere trifling play of the body? "Now just forget your intellect a while," says the man, "you're not qualified to judge because you've never tried it. Dance with me and you'll see for yourself." So saying, he embraces me and drags me out into the whirling mass of people, acting just as foolishly as all the other people. I dance with him and observe myself with great curiosity. Will I too become as intoxicated, as carried away by the close contact as these poor demented people about me? But the only thing I notice is how extremely unpleasant I find the close proximity of this man. His breath is hot, and I find it very revolting for him to be breathing into my face and down my neck. Exhaled air is used up air. Why should I be inhaling air he has already used up? Then too, I find the odor of his body and his perspiration most unpleasant. I want fresh air. I want to get away from this repugnant place. As I try to get away from him, the man suddenly changes. In a trice he turns into a gigantic, fiery flaming spirit. He no longer has a body. He is only a mighty flame, trying to force me into subjection. He surrounds me, trying to force himself into my mouth, into my body. But the power I radiate, the power of my clear and sober consciousness, keeps him away. He cannot reach me. He reacts by growing hotter, greater, more eager. He takes on tremendous proportions, spreading throughout the whole room, devouring all these passion-drunk people in his consuming fire. Nobody is left. Nothing more. Only a sea of flames, devouring and consuming everything. But I stand untouched, unscathed, and I am that I am. Then I hear a thunderous voice from out of the flames, "You have won. You have passed your test, but watch out. You haven't won because you're stronger than I. You can't be stronger, because I'm the fire of your own self. You just didn't come alight because your purity and your lack of experience stand between you and me. Your body and its senses are still sleeping. That's what protected you. But watch out, we'll meet again. We'll meet again." And with that everything disappears, fire, room, smoke, everything. And I find myself alone again. "We'll meet again?" I repeat these last words. "I'm not afraid of you. Even if my body had burst into flaming passion, this would not have touched myself. I stand above everything physical." But what was that? Didn't it sound like a scornful laugh? I look around to see where this voice may have come from. So doing, I notice that I'm in a meadow as green as emerald, and a strange form is approaching. It's the form of a handsome, well-built man, half concealed by a veil of mist. I'd like to see through the mist. I'd like to see the splendid form it hides. I'd like to chase the mist away. But I can't. But the man interests me, and so I ask, "Who are you?" Then the handsome man comes close, and with a voice that makes a deep impression on me he whispers into my ear, "Oh my sweet beloved, I've been looking for you for a long, long time, for an eternity, ever since we fell out of the Garden of Eden and became separated from each other. At last I've found you. I come into my arms. Come, lay your sweet little head upon my breast. Come and let us unite in divine unity, let us merge our beings in heavenly bliss. How wonderful that you haven't yielded to the animal urge of the body. How glorious that you've kept yourself pure and untouched for me. You belong to me and I belong to you. We supplement each other completely. Do you feel the irresistible power of attraction that links us and draws us closer and closer together? Come, let us unite in love, you dearest of creatures, my one and only heavenly bride. I love you." I hear his voice, I see his manly stride, I feel a tremendous force radiating from him to me. And yet he's strange. I don't know him. How could he be my complementary half? No. One never finds the complementary half outside oneself. Tahotep says our complementary half is always behind the manifested form as a mirrored image in the unmanifested state. No. No human being can be my complementary half. And why is this man veiled in a dense mist? I don't know who you are, I answer him, but whoever you are, you're mistaken. You're not my complementary half. And you'll have to look elsewhere for yours if you think you'll find it anywhere in the outside world. No one can find his complementary half anywhere except within himself. In the world around us, it's only possible to find projected pictures similar to one's true complementary half. But neither you nor I can become complete by virtue of a picture, a projection. Only the divine unity of the self can bring blissful happiness. I'll find my complementary half within myself. To find your complementary half within yourself, says the handsome man, would mean that you, in your consciousness, were already identical with the divine self. How do you expect to experience the consequence before the cause? The divine self is the paradisiacal state of unity through which you can only return through becoming one with your complementary half. How do you expect to achieve this without me, without your complementary half? You're forgetting that you are half of a unit and I am the other half. We are the living reflected images of each other, and we belong together. You carry me about in your subconscious, just as I carry you in mine, and even without wanting to, we seek each other with the irresistible attractive force that comes from our belonging together in the paradisiacal state. Throughout ages and ages of time, our fate brings us together again and again until we make each other conscious within ourselves and experience each other completely in body as well as in soul. Only in this divine identity can we really be the total consciousness of the whole, of the higher self. How do you expect to be able to return to paradisiacal unity without me? How do you think you could escape from facing the fact that we also belong to each other on the earthly plane? How do you expect to get the experience you absolutely need, without me? But I refuse to allow myself to be influenced. No matter how much you try to convince me, I still don't want you. As far as I'm concerned, it's enough to know that you're present in the unconscious part of myself, and I only want to get acquainted with you within myself, but not in the outer world. Get on your way and let me get on mine. At these words of mine, the handsome man recedes and begins to evaporate like a morning mist in the sunshine. And from farther and farther away his voice comes back to me, this voice that has made such a deep impression on my heart, "I'll go on looking for you on the earthly plane. Looking. Looking." His voice fades away in the distance, and suddenly all is quiet. But there's still something I want to know. So I shout after him, "Why is there such a heavy mist about you, so heavy it keeps me from seeing you face to face?" From far away in the distance I hear a voice fading out as if it were the echo of my own heartbeat, "The heavy mist is covering your eyes, not me. It's your lack of experience. That's what's protecting you from me. It has helped you resist me. But we'll meet again. There's still a lot I'd like to ask," and I run towards the spot where he's disappeared. but I see him no more. One turn around to go back to the beautiful meadow, but I can't find the way. There is a dense mist covering everything wherever I look. No matter how hard I try, I just can't see through it. Yet I know I'm no longer alone. I hear voices of people around me, and I know that there is some kind of a relationship between these people and myself. Various events follow each other in which I play an important part. I hear voices speaking to me, and again I recognize the voice that spoke to me from out of the misty figure and made such a deep impression on me. I realize that this being, in various different forms, belongs to me again and again, but how and where? What are these voices all saying? And what am I answering? I can't quite fathom it. It's as if the mist were covering my ears as well as my eyes. Now and again I see something, but before I can recognize what it is, it disappears again in the mist. Once I see a tower, and I know that someone is living within it as a prisoner. He has the same voice as that of the misty figure, and I hurry to try to smuggle in something to eat. I am the daughter of the gatekeeper, and I have to watch out that no one notices me. But an overpowering force draws me towards the prisoner. I know I must help him. Then everything disappears again in the mists about me. As I try to get my bearings again, I suddenly see large, colored stone tiles just in front of my face. I wash and scrub them until they're clean. Then again in the mist I hear a voice that sounds like my own, asking over and over, "Have you found my child?" I get the impression that an old, decrepit body, which somehow or other is related to myself, is very, very tired. Then this strange feeling disappears, and suddenly, to my great joy, the mist disappears too. Once again I am standing in the green meadow. Now I am ready to go on. The air is fresh. The sun is shining, but still it's not unbearably hot. How strange. Never before have I noticed that it wasn't hot at midday, and now there's even a gentle pleasant breeze. There's something more that's strange too. As the mists disappear and I see the ground below my feet again, I notice that my feet as well as the ground they stand on arc much farther down than they ever have been before. That means I've grown much taller. How peculiar. At my age a person doesn't grow anymore. So how is it possible for me to have grown taller? And what a remarkable dress I have on. It's really funny. And where are my sandals? And my hands? How very much they've changed. Everything is so peculiar, as surprising as if I were not myself, as if I were dreaming. But my consciousness is clear. I'm awake. I'm not dreaming. I look around. Not far away I see a forest, and as I approach it, a house becomes visible among the trees. But what a strange house. The place seems familiar to me, and yet I know that I've never seen such trees in all my life, nor such a house. No. These trees are not even remotely similar to our palms. The house stands on a hill. And as I go up the steps through the forest leading to it, I know the house belongs to me. But how? I've never seen such a house, and yet it is familiar to me. It's not made of stone, and its roof is slanting instead of flat. As I enter the house, I know every room is familiar, so I walk straight into my room. As I step into the little room with its whitewashed walls, I stop before the window for a few moments to enjoy the magnificent view. I see that both the little house and the beautiful green meadow are high up on a mountainside, offering a view into the wide plain below. At the foot of the mountain a broad river flows majestically past with big ships navigating on its surface. Singularly enough, they have no sails and no oars, yet move along very fast, much faster than our ships. Another thing I don't understand is why they all have a big, black pipe sticking up and spewing out thick black smoke. The sun has gone down, and twilight is spreading out over the valley below me. Off in the distance where, I have a strange feeling I have often looked out before, there are many little villages, and between them and over them I see little flashes of lightning. Again and again. And after each flash there is a clap of thunder, just the way the thunder booms out of the Great Pyramid. I observe these flashes of light and this thundering for a while until suddenly a shrill bell rings behind me. I turn to the little apparatus that is emitting this ringing sound, lift up an odd-shaped part of this apparatus and press part of it to my ear. All of this seems just as much a matter of course as if I had been accustomed to doing it for a long, long time, yet I know precisely that I've never seen such a thing in my life before. As I hold the little round black part of this apparatus to my ear, I again hear the voice. The voice that spoke from out of the misty figure, "I kiss your hands, darling, how are you?"
"Thanks, fine," I reply, "but I'd like to come back home. Could you perhaps come and fetch me tomorrow? The enemy is already quite close. Every evening I see the hits. They're coming closer and closer with frightening speed. I'd like to be home with all of you."
"All right," answers the voice of the man again, "I'll come tomorrow to get you. But wouldn't it be more sensible if you were to stay in the forest? Here in the city we're getting bombarded day and night, and it's getting worse."
"No," I answer, "I want to be back home with all the rest of you. I've taken care of the house and property here, but when danger is near, I want to be with the rest of you. Please take me home."
"Good," I hear again out of the apparatus. "I can see you have courage enough. Tomorrow afternoon I'll come and pick you up. Get all your things packed before then. Goodbye, my darling. I kiss you again and again. Good night."
"I kiss you too. Good night."
I answer and put the apparatus back where it was before. Who was that? How do I come to hear his voice speaking to me through an odd-shaped piece of apparatus? How come I hear him with my physical ear instead of through an inner link of spirit? A thought flashes through my brain: is perhaps everything I am experiencing now only a vision? Perhaps it's only a dream? Only a test of my courage? No, unfortunately, it's not a dream, however much I might like to wake up out of this reality, just as I woke up before out of a dream and found myself in the midst of a beautiful green meadow. Yes, that was a dream. But now I'm wide awake and have to deal with all kinds of things. Unavoidably. The air is heavy with fear and terror. So heavy people can hardly breathe. The enemy is approaching from every side. If this goes on for a few days more, the city will be surrounded. And we keep hearing such unbelievably horrible stories from the refugees who have succeeded in escaping from the occupied areas. But we are in the hand of God. And I calm my anxious heart and nerves with the thought that everything that happens is for the good, because nothing can happen without God's will. And God's will is always good, absolutely always. I start to pack my things quickly. The next afternoon, I look up at the window and see our dog running down the mountainside like a streak of greased lightning. That's how I know my husband is coming. A few minutes later, they arrive. My husband and our dog. Our dog is so happy. He jumps up to greet my husband again and again, up to shoulder height out of pure enthusiasm and excitement. I run out to meet him too and we embrace each other with tender affection. We've been living together for nearly 20 years and are just as much in love as the day we married. My husband's bearing and manner, his voice and the warm touch of his hand are all so reassuring. He is courage, safety, dependability itself. "I hope you're not afraid?" he asks me with a smile.
"No," I answer as I lace my arms around his muscular back.
"God will be with us." I snuggle up close to him for a moment, leaning my head on his broad shoulder. As we start to pack the luggage in the car, I stand still for a moment. "What kind of a car, carriage or chariot is this?" I suddenly remember that I'm accustomed to traveling in quite a different kind, but then I smile again because this is one I know very well too. Of course it's my husband's car, but how strange that it runs by itself, with no lions harnessed up in front of it. I stroke my forehead with my hand. Have I gone completely mad? Lions. Lions in front of a motor car? And here in this country? Yes indeed. There were some beautiful lions in the zoo, but they were long ago put to death because of the bombings. It would have been dangerous if one of the wild beasts had been freed because of bomb damage to its cage.
I can't understand where I get ideas like these about lions and other impossible things. The pyramids of Egypt, which I certainly only know from photographs. Have I perhaps become a victim of too much excitement?